Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Gary Steves from Courage Canada. So tell me a little bit about Courage Canada.
Courage Canada is a national charity. It was started back in 2008 by Mark DeMontis, and basically, the goal of the charity is to help teach kids how to skate and play hockey who are visually impaired, as well as sort of helping oversee the adult blind ice hockey programs. And we've been involved in sort of developing this sport over those, however many years that is now, I guess, 7 years or so. So we do kind of two main things we've done over the last couple of years is we do learn to skate programs across the country for kids who are visually impaired or blind. We partner with the vision teachers in those areas to put on the programs, and we mostly do now kind of a dual sport thing, so we'll do one sport in the morning or afternoon and skating the other time, so we usually introduce them to goalball or soccer or something like that as well, and that's a really powerful program. We get the kids together with, they're often kind of on their own in each school they're in, so they get together with a bunch of their own peers, and it's really, really cool, really powerful to see them together and kind of sharing things, that sort of thing. And then the other thing we do is we have a national tournament every year in Toronto, the kind of adult ice hockey programs, and so started in 2013, and that was the first ever round-robin hockey tournament for the blind held in the world at any time, so it was pretty cool, and it's grown from having 45 players to last year we had almost 80 players, and we had a 16 tournament, so it's a continuously growing event, which is awesome.
So, in these programs, is there any modified equipment used for the athletes?
So basically for the skating, not so much. It's just more about helping the kids get orientated to the rink. So when we do the programs, we usually give them like an actual rink tour, not just of the ice, but like, you know, show them the Zamboni, those kind of things. And on the ice, it's more about just having people having kind of one-on-one with them and depending on their skating ability. And when it gets to hockey, we use an adaptive puck. It's made out of metal. It's about 5.5 inches wide and kind of proportionally the same sort of proportions as a normal puck, so it's kind of 1 3/8 inches high or something like that. Has 10 ball bearings in it. And so the thing with that is it's bigger, so people with partial sight can see it, and it moves slower than a normal puck does, also helping people with partial sight. And when it's moving, it's making noise, so helping all of us with whatever level of vision we have to kind of hear it as well. So generally in the blind hockey, people with more vision, so kind of being quote-unquote legally blind, a strange term, but is under 10% vision, which is either your field, what you see peripherally, or your acuity, which you see straight ahead. So the puck helps them to kind of pick it up, and then people, you know, goes down to people having little sight to almost to basically no sight, because people are totally blind. They usually are playing defense or goalie in hockey. So that's the puck is kind of the main adaptive tool we use, and then we sort of modify the rules a little bit. So we have a rule where you cross the red line, you have to make one pass, and that just kind of helps participation in a sense, so that the people with more skills and possibly more vision don't take the game over. It makes it more participation, and also gives information for the people playing goalie and defense who have low vision to kind of get a bit more information where the puck's going. And then we just have a couple modified rules around the net. Goals already scored in the bottom 3 feet of the net because the puck doesn't make any noise in the air, so it makes it a bit more fair for the goalie. And just a safety rule, when the puck hits the goalie and stops moving in the crease in the blue paint, then
So, how do you go about spreading the word about Courage Canada?
We try and do lots of different things like interviews, and we have a website, couragecanada.ca, has all kinds of information on there. And we basically really kind of through word of mouth through the programs we do, and people like vision teachers sharing about our youth program, and trying to get as much media coverage as possible so that for several reasons, as long as we want people who are visually impaired, you know, either young kids or older people who are interested in hockey or learning how to skate to hear about us. And secondly, all this stuff costs money, so we're always trying to find new sponsors and get them connected with the organization and the vision and mission of the organization as well.
So, in your time with the organization, is there any one success moment that stood out for you?
There's been so many of those kind of things. I think last year was one of the coolest things. We had the first ever youth blind hockey camp in Burnaby, BC. And so we brought in 12 kids from ages 12 to 18 from across the country and had a full-blown hockey camp. So for 2 hours a day, every day, we had coaches out there and had to do all kinds of hockey drills. And then in the afternoon, we'd do different sports as well. And again, like, I guess what was the, it's just kind of cool in so many ways, like first on the ice, like me watching their skills kind of develop over that time. I was playing goal for a lot of that. So, you know, the first day they're doing like shootout drills and stuff, and then not getting too many passings. But by the last day, they did that at the last practice as well, a shootout drill, and they're just scoring it on the will, it seems. So they'd really kind of learned a lot, and that's sort of the sports side of it. But the other part that was really amazing is watching them and watching them bond with each other and share with each other, and the pure group and pure support. Like, it was just amazing. It was really wonderful to watch. And even their parents are out here as well for the camp as well. And watching them, too, get to talk to their other parents who are sharing the same experiences and figuring out how to break down some barriers and different problems. And just being part of that, it was really beautiful. Our last sort of, you know, meeting we had before everybody left, it was really emotional because it was just, I think everybody had gained so much. And I guess that was one of the most powerful moments. But there's, you know, every time we do a program, there's always something that happens where, you know, one of the kids or one of the youth there, it's always very touching. You know, there'll be somebody who never thought they could skate, and they're out on the ice, and they're just kind of going nuts, and, you know, really into it. Or be a kid who played sighted hockey, and his sight is kind of decreasing, and he's kind of not being able to keep up with that game, and him, too, thinking, oh, I can never play hockey, and finding out about Courage Canada and the opportunities, and seeing his excitement, and his parents' excitement. There's so many moments. That's why I really love working with Courage Canada. You get to really see the results of what you do, and I think that's really beautiful.
So, if you could send any one message about the need for inclusive sport, what would it be?
I guess the key thing, I mean, my key message, I guess, I sort of live by and really believe Courage Canada helps to bring forward is that we want to introduce people to skating, but really what we're trying to introduce people, the kids and the parents and the vision teachers and the public, everybody to, is that if somebody is visually impaired, they can do basically anything. They might need some adaptations to it, but you know, there's really no barriers except the barriers that we put up. So for me, that's about sport and physical activity, is really about empowering people who are visually impaired or blind through sport, kind of get their confidence and realize that they can take on anything else in life, because they have so many successes. You see the kids we're talking about earlier having successes at skating and hockey. And I know from my own experiences that when I was younger doing these kind of things, that it really does transfer into your life, that you learn that there's not, you know, the barriers are barriers that you put up. And sometimes, you know, you've got to find ways around things and adapt things to make them work. But it's about educating people and you know, making everybody understand that you can do whatever you want. And I think that's
like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yep, no problem. Thank you very much for having me.
Of course. Courage Canada. In many ways, the name really does say it all. For these individuals aren't having courage because they're individuals with disabilities out there engaging in their sport. No. In my mind, they have courage because they're willing defy the norm. They're willing to take something many of us in society would say There's no way to do it. Their impairment is something which is counter to making this possible. However, it's organizations like this one that say, I'm not willing to live with that. I'm not willing to simply accept society's first glance thoughts on this. I'm going to look into it. I'm going to find a way. And I'm going to try to spread the word about that way to the point at which it can reach others, can benefit others. Having the most fantastic disabilities, idea, or inspiration is fine, but it's far less impacting if a person keeps it to themselves. But within the disabled community, what you would often find is families reaching out to each other, organizations reaching out to each other, and saying, I've got this really incredible idea, this really fantastic solution. Why don't you give it a try as well? Might work for you, it might not. But at the very least, it's a step forward. And that's what it all comes down to in disability life. Taking steps forward. Recognizing potential where others might not. Saying to yourself, is there a way to make this work for this person? Can I see beyond the obvious? Can I ask the questions that would make things better for this individual? Can I be that someone who brings something meaningful to their world and says, you're someone with capabilities, you're someone with potentials, you have hopes, you have dreams, I recognize this, and I want to be that person who encourages you. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Brain injury is the leading killer and disabler of people under the age of 44 and kills more people under the age of 20 than any other causes combined. Texting or talking on a cell phone while operating a motorized vehicle can lead to serious car crashes, brain injuries, or death. Take the pledge and help put a stop to distracted driving. Go to idontpledge.com to make a pledge to drive only. Never text. Everyone deserves to travel on our roads and communities without the fear of a distracted driver.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Gary Steeves from Courage Canada. I was talking a little bit about seeing potential in disability life where others might not. Our guest for the second half of the show, someone who sees such potential and encourages it on a day-by-day basis. Please welcome Melissa Miner from the Downtown Music Initiative. She'll be talking about what it's like to teach music to individuals with disabilities. So tell me a little bit about your experiences giving music lessons to students with disabilities.
Okay, well, some of our students have disabilities such as learning disabilities or attention deficit disabilities, as well as one person has cerebral palsy. Also another disability that two of our students have is oppositional defiance disorder. So we don't really have a lot of kids with physical disabilities other than the one young student with cerebral palsy. The experiences of teaching students with disabilities is the same as any other student in that every lesson is a little different. Like, no two kids learn the same way.
Right? So do you typically find that they have the same potential to learn and develop as a student?
Absolutely, yeah. Like, kids that are that were diagnosed with learning disabilities, they just need a different sort of teaching regime. Like, we have one teacher, and with her students, she has two students that have diagnosed learning disabilities, and she's also a supply teacher in the school board, so she has teaching experience in general. But what she does is She does daily logs, like exactly what to practice each day that they practice, and they have to sort of put their initial on the things they practiced that day. And if they followed the log, and if it proves in their playing that they followed the log, then like there's that reward system. But the reward system is for any student in general. It's just their notes might look a little different. Like they might not have a very extremely specific practice log. But the reward for improvement for between each week as a result of practicing is basically the same. It's just the means to get there is different. So
these students with disabilities, do you find they benefit as much from the music instruction as any other student?
So far it's showing that in some ways they benefit more in terms of being organized and accountability, because it is that one-on-one situation, the teacher can recognize if they haven't followed their practice regime, I guess, and through that one-on-one accountability, I guess they're just more motivated to keep to an agenda, whereas in a big classroom they might not get that kind of attention that they might need, and sort of not be held accountable to that high of standard. And then also in a performance, just to see themselves play and hear themselves play so well at a recital or public performance, as well as all the other students, it's like they're just fitting in with all the other students. So that might be more of a rewarding experience, that they're just as successful as anyone else. So like, what is so different, you know, about it?
Yeah. So in some ways it provides sort of a chance to reach out for a student who might not necessarily have had such before.
Yeah, like the program itself is for kids from low-income families, and so in that sense it reaches out to lower income families that wouldn't otherwise have means to afford lessons, and then kids with learning disabilities in those families, or with cerebral palsy or whatever, the parents, I'm not sure how to say it, children in those situations, music lessons might be the last thing that's on the parents' mind for that. So to have this kind of attention and weekly practice, it's something that's a lot of fun, as well as exposure to many different instruments, because we offer many instruments. That is something that can't be offered in any school system. And so they wouldn't get it at school, they wouldn't get it at home. And that like potential for resiliency, potential for growth through music education in the one-on-one setting, there's no way that it could happen. Yeah.
So sounds to me like you're getting a lot of the same benefits of practices such as music therapy, which is an acknowledged practice for kids with learning and physical disabilities.
Yeah. So it's therapeutic in the sense that they are building their own skill and knowing that they have, knowing that they're gaining experience, that they're participating with everyone else regardless of differences, that they're playing together, because we have music groups too, like bands, rock bands, and duets and that sort of thing. And just being part of the Downtown Music Initiative's students, in that in of itself, the teamwork, the focused attention, the accomplishments, because they get many performance opportunities. We perform once a month out in the community. So, all of that added together is therapeutic in the sense that it's building resiliency, building confidence, and that sort of stuff. So
in your time working with these students, is there any one success moment that stood out for you?
There's many. Okay, so there's one. Oh, geez. Okay, there's two. I'm going to narrow it down to two. Okay. One girl that has the cerebral palsy, she started out with vocals with us because both her mom and I, too, didn't think she could actually play an instrument because her fingers were so, like, stiff and, like, curved and just, like, not nimble for playing piano. And so she was taking vocals with us, and she would go up to our music library of all of our donated books, and she would look through some of the voice music and try to plunk it out on piano just with like one finger at a time. And then she asked to borrow one of our piano beginner books, and she started plunking that out on the piano. And then her mom's friend gave the family a keyboard, so she took the piano books home and started like with the keyboard because it's lighter touch. There's less resistance, so it's a little bit easier to play. She started playing with more fingers, and now she's actually taking piano lessons. At this recital, she's playing a piano solo, and she learns music notes really quickly, and her brain. And her eyesight's like, it's like her brain can read the music and knows what it is, and her fingers are now catching up to what she is able to process cognitively. So whereas I thought physically would be impossible, because in piano you need all five of your fingers, they need to be curved, she can now do. She does have alternate fingering, just because of the fine motor skills is still like very difficult, but she's playing her music and she's playing just like everyone else, and she's playing a solo, and I think she's doing quite well. So, and she very much enjoys it, and all of it was her own initiative. So yeah, so I thought that was pretty cool. So
what was the second story you
Okay, so the other story is this girl who takes piano with us, and she has attention deficit disorder, learning disabilities, and also diagnosed oppositional defiance disorder, and it's basically all the cards are stacked against her in terms of family situation and her diagnosis, and she takes piano, and she has a hard time focusing, and she sort of gives the teacher a bit of a hard time, and doesn't really follow through on her practicing. But her teacher hasn't given up on her, and she's still doing well on piano. But I heard her while she was waiting for her piano lesson. I heard her singing with one of our volunteers just for fun. And she was singing singing an octave higher than the volunteer, like this really high pitch. It was so beautiful and like such an angelic tone. And the only time she stands still is when she sings. Other than that, she's like off, like all around the place, like, you know, just, you know. So anyway, so then I got her into voice lessons. One of our voice teachers agreed to stay late on Wednesdays and teach her. So as a result, she now takes voice lessons and has sung two solos at two different retirement homes. And she's just, it's kind of a success story in that sometimes when kids get there, they learn one instrument, but then they sort of stumble on hidden talent. And that is sort of a story of how we just sort of stumbled on that, whoa, this girl can sing, and she sings very, very well. Definitely a natural talent. So anyways, and in those lessons, the singing lessons, she can go for half an hour straight, whereas in piano, like after the first 5 minutes, she's done. She can't like focus anymore past that. So I guess she might have found her niche in that sense. So,
yeah. I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this.
And you're welcome.
Melissa's work really spoke to me in so much as her intention was just to provide music instruction to low-income families, but it's branched out and had the side effect of providing therapeutic benefits for individuals with disabilities. It's a wonderful thing, something that couldn't have been planned for from the beginning, but it's giving them the opportunity to express their skill, to find what they're good at, and yes, to get to know members of the community. The worst thing that can be done for a person with a disability is to isolate them, tell them they don't really fit in society. Through her instruction program, Melissa's found a way to help these individuals find their comfort zone, if you will, a way of expressing themselves in a social, very public setting, by giving performances, showcasing their skills. It's exactly as it should be. Individuals with disabilities out in the community saying, I have something to contribute. I'm on an equal footing with any other musician. I have potentials to learn, to grow, to succeed. It's the same in any facet of disability life. These individuals should be recognized for their skills. Just look at the person first and their capabilities. Recognize they're out there contributing, not because they want to make a public statement about their disability necessarily, but because in many cases it's what they love to do. They're simply expressing themselves as anyone else would. There's no difference in disabilities, music instruction, and able-bodied. Sure, there's going to be a time or two where the methods are a little different. No two people learn exactly the same way, exactly the same rate. Adapting programs, that's for everybody, not simply because someone might have one characteristic. It's a little bit different. But it's the wonderful thing in disability life. It's about learning about all types of people, learning from their strengths, their experiences, and growing stronger what they choose to do, not because they're overcoming perceived barriers, but because they're excelling at the things they love to do. We as a society should look at the accomplishment and say to ourselves, gee, isn't it great that someone in society managed to do this? That they created art or music that touched our lives, touched our hearts. Not say to ourselves, this is incredible because a person with a disability did it. Say, it's incredible because it was done, because it bettered the world, because what they did brightened things up a little. The world is more complete now because a person added to it, whether they have a disability or not. Recognize the accomplishment, value the work, and value the person contributing it. Recognize there are potentials, hopes, dreams in everyone, with a disability or without. If you're someone with the story of disability life, write handylink4@gmail.com, handylink, the numeral 4, gmail.com. Always love to hear from you folks at home. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.